George Costanza's line.
Actually, I gotta say, my hard work has now passed, okay? Because I came in the middle of the night from L.A. I had been on 3 hours sleep. I drove up here, or down here from Boston, and I got up there for 25 minutes and talked at you and delivered content, right? But for the rest of the weekend, really, this is about us. It's about a conversation that we're going to have. So, actually, my hard work is now over, and our hard work is going to begin, because I'm now going to move into the mode that I taught last night, which is really about the power of the collective. And the power of the collective isn't just rolling up our sleeves and doing work together. The power of the collective is collective thinking, collective insight, collective learning, and a sort of a relational way to engage our own intellect. And, of course, you know, what is the central way that Jews learn? If you go to yeshiva, or I don't know, maybe it's a minhag or a custom here, what's the way Jews often study Torah together?
In groups.
In chavrusa. Right? People know what the word chavrusa is. Chavrusa common is something that happens. Right?
Yeah.
And the notion that the text comes alive when people actually interact and talk with one another and talk with each other. So we'll do some chavrusa, some learning in pairs in a little bit. But let me just frame what we're going to do a little bit this morning. So the parsha, the Torah portion is
Noah.
Okay, parsha Noah. Turn your text sheet over. Thank you. Because now you won't be tempted to say, let's skip ahead and see what we're doing. So it's parsha Noah, and I want to put Noah in the context of the wider meta narrative of Torah. So you know, remember? I don't know if you've ever seen that one-man show, the guy who does all of Shakespeare in 33 minutes, right? Or the right. So we're going to do like a two-minute run-through. If somebody asked you, a neighbor or one of your kids or a non-Jew, so what is the story of the Torah? And you had like a sentence to say, well, the Torah tells the story of. How would you answer that question?
Dysfunctional families.
Okay. In what book?
What?
Dysfunctional
family. Right, Genesis. Genesis is a lot of dysfunctional families, although once you move into Exodus, and certainly Leviticus, it's not really about dysfunctional families anymore, right? That's a theme of Genesis. So look at the wider context of the five books, right? From A to Z and what happens in between, right? Stories have a beginning, middle, and an end. So the beginning begins, actually before the dysfunctional families, the beginning begins with creation, right? The origin and nature of the universe. Right, the existence of the universe. In the beginning, what was there?
Void.
Void, right? Well, not just void. There was one thing, one something. What was before the chaos? What was before the dark?
God.
Okay, before there was anything, there was God. God occupied all of space, all of existence. God was the totality of existence and universe. And God made other things happen inside of God. Okay? So it's the beginning of the story is really about not just God, but creation and existence. And once creation happens, in the universe, what occupies that space inside of the universe, the earth, and all of the array that we see around us? How does God fill up that space? Fill up that creation? Us, right? Human beings, right? All of that book of Bereshit that we read, or the Parsha Bereshit that we read last week culminates in the creation of human beings, right? Each day something else happens, and what happens at the end of each day? God says, this is good. And then on the last day, God says about human beings, this is very good, right? And so it's sort of this build-up to the creation of humanity. Now, fast forward for a second to the end of Torah, right? Where are we at the end of the story?
Entering the land.
On the verge of entering the land. So another beginning is about to happen, the entry into the land. So think about the shape of that narrative. If you have at one end of the story creation, which is just about God creating humanity, right? And at the other end, who's about to enter the land?
Jewish
the Jewish people, Israel. Right, the people of Israel now, about to enter Israel. Oops. I don't know what Kravitz would say, but I chose green to write Israel. Maybe it's different interfaith relations. Kravitz said always it was blue for Jewish thought, green for Islamic thought. And you had to know that. So that's the journey, right? From creation so that God could exist in space with human beings, right? And the first human being was the ultimate universal, right, human with no particularity, to a very particular story of a people, Israel, going into a particular land. What happens in between? What's the arc of this narrative?
Slavery, Exodus, and wandering.
Okay, so you have slavery and Exodus as a turning point. But this doesn't actually occupy the geographic center of Torah, right? What occupies the geographic center? What's the halfway point? Not Sinai, actually. Sinai happens, is the kickoff to the center, right? But why did you say Sinai? I think it's a good reflection, Bill. Why Sinai? You know, I should have done this at the beginning. As we talk, let's use names just so I can begin to. So, Bill, why Sinai? It makes some sense, actually.
Sinai is where we got the Torah, and the Torah is at the center of the people of Israel.
And so how is this a turning point? If it's when we got the Torah, and we became, so why, how is that a turning point for this people as they're journeying towards their destiny, which is to be a people in a land?
It came from God.
Rededication to monotheism, though Abraham had a dedication to monotheism, but it was small, right? It's one guy, one family.
Rules of the game?
Rules of the game for who?
For the church.
For this people, right? This is the beginning of peoplehood. This is the beginning of the collective understanding itself as a collective, right? The moment of culmination really happens not when we get out of slavery, right? Not when we get freed from something, but when we enter into something.
Well, freedom is responsibility, so that's what it is.
Well, and as a lot of theologians suggest, the philosophers, the Exodus narrative is partly about freedom from, right? I can't be oppressed by Pharaoh. But really, it is about the freedom to enter into a sacred covenant and receive responsibility, right? So this turning point moment is the people gathered at the mountain, entering into the covenant, accepting responsibility from God and expecting responsibility of God. And then they can go forward in their journey. What flows, right? They stand at Sinai, they get the law, they accept the covenant, they build the tabernacle, right? So if you're in the middle of a cattle campaign, you understand that. Big community building enterprise, right? The cattle campaign is not just about raising the money, it's about everybody becoming a stakeholder in this institution. The tabernacle was the same thing, right? Everybody had to give something so that the Israelites could move together in the wilderness. And then the geographic center is Leviticus. Not the most popular book in the world, right? Why? What's Leviticus full of?
Rules.
Rules. Just lots and lots and lots of rules about how this community is going to operate. In ways that seem antiquated and archaic to us in many instances. But that's what it was. Right? The geographic center really is just a long list of the way we're going to operate together. It isn't so exciting, but that's life. Right? Most of our lives are not filled with Sinaitic moments of revelation. The peak, right? It can't always be the Super Bowl. Sometimes it's just like getting your kids to school or picking up your, you know, mom from a doctor's appointment or whatever it is, right? That's life. So the journey then, I would suggest, the meta-narrative is God in relation with the human being and the journey of God in relation to the universal human being to relating to particular human beings and ultimately to the particular community known as Israel who needs to come together as a people in order to be a community in covenant with God. Now, why does God get to that place where God wants to relate to a community in a particular way who enter into covenant with God? Think about it. God creates human beings. How well does that go?
Not too good.
Not so good. I'm going to take my jacket off. Is that right? Not too good, right? What goes wrong? I'm going to be just, what doesn't go wrong? I'm going to be, right? What goes wrong?
Everything,
right? What's the first thing that happens? What's our first human being story?
One brother kills another brother.
Even before that one. But that's where things start really going, right?
They disobey.
Right, the first thing, right? Don't do that. You just did it. So what is God beginning to learn?
He can't control them.
It's very hard to learn. Right? And that's in essence, right? And all of us that have kids understand, right? As you learn how to parent, the minute kids begin to evolve with consciousness, they have what we call a will of their own, just like human beings. So God thinks, oh, I'm going to make this yummy toy and put it in the garden. But I'm still God. I get to decide. I'm the decider. You do this, you don't do this. Boom. The first thing they do is push back and disagree. And then it all breaks down as the very first offspring of those human beings kill each other. It's not going so well. Right? And that is sort of the prologue to today's story. Right? So God is learning in the very first Torah portion all of God's interactions with this human being that God wants to relate to for some reason aren't going so well. The first human beings disobey God. The second human beings kill one another. And then we get Noah. Now, what's the foreshadow to Noah? Or not the foreshadow, the prologue to Noah. What's the context in which Noah exists? You don't have to know too much to know this. What's going on in the world?
It was an abysmal culture. They had no rules. It was basically just one orgy running around. There was nothing going
on. The word for this in the text is Hamas. It was violent or wicked or chaos, right? A whole generation of wickedness, chaos, evil. So then we're moving from this very individual story, this individualized narrative of Adam and Eve disobeying, of Cain killing Abel, this sort of micro-narrative of dissension, of disagreement, of disobedience, of sin, into a meta-narrative. Right, where the whole community is rotten. That's the context into which Noah comes. Okay? So let's open our Chumashim. Any comments or reflections about the meta-narrative? And as you open your Chumashim, we're looking. Okay, so there's the small story, right? Which is the story of Noah. That's the small story. The meta-narrative is the big picture, the big story. And I'm going to try and I'll make sure to stay on time so we get back to this. I want to try and figure out not just what Noah has to teach us in terms of his own little story, but what it means for the meta-narrative of what it means to be an Israelite community. What does it mean to be a Jewish community? Because at the end of the day, I'm trying to make some arguments over the course of this weekend about what does it mean to be an organized community, to act together, to be Israel standing again at the mountain, receiving the responsibility of being in the covenant. What does that mean for us? Well, what can we learn from Noah's actions and Noah's behavior in the meta-narrative of the journey God has in relating to humanity as a whole, to God to relating to us as individual people, the Muslims across town, the Christians on the other side of the street, and the Jews here in this synagogue. Does that make sense? Alright? Okay. What page is it on, Jeff?
It is on 57.
Great. And is it your tradition to say a blessing before you say it? Okay. And is it less open to break around it? Alright, so, page 57. So let's join together. Baruch
atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Tishanu B'Mitzvotah Tzivanu La'asot B'Divrei Torah.
Amen. Somebody read verse 9. This is the line.
This is the line of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. He was blameless in his age. Noah walked with God.
Keep going. We'll read the first up till 16.
Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth became corrupt before God. The earth was filled with lawlessness. When God saw how corrupt the earth was, for all flesh had corrupted its ways on earth, God said to Noah, I have decided to put an end to all flesh, for the earth is filled with lawlessness because of them. I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make an ark with compartments and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Make an opening for daylight in the ark, and terminate it within a cubit of the top. Put the entrance to the ark in its side. Make it with bottom, second, and third decks. For my part, I am about to bring the flood, waters upon the earth, to destroy all flesh under the sky, in which there is breath of life. Everything on earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, with your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives. And of all that lives, of all flesh, you shall take two of each into the ark to keep alive with you. They shall be male and female. From birds of every kind, cattle of every kind of creeping thing on earth, two of each shall come to you to stay alive. For your part, take of everything that is eaten and stored away to serve as food for you and for them. Noah did so just as God commanded him, so he did.
Okay, we're going to pause there. Excellent. Excellent. Any questions of comprehension before we move into the text? Maybe something you didn't understand, or a word that doesn't make sense, or just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Okay, so here's what. Yeah, go ahead.
Well,
say your name.
Helen.
Good morning, Helen.
You would think that if God had created the earth, the world, he would have set down how he wanted people to behave. He didn't. So there is a question of will here. Otherwise, everyone would have behaved.
Excellent. So that's actually a wonderful foreshadow to this Sinaitic moment, right? Potentially, God is beginning to learn, right? If later God realizes, well, I need to give Israel a set of laws to live by, right? And presumably after the flood happens, by the way, and Noah comes out of the ark, what is the first thing God gives Noah? People, if you've read the story before, if you've read ahead in the Parsha.
There's a promise you wouldn't pull his flood business again.
Okay, he says, I won't do this again. There's a sign in the sky of the keshet, of the rainbow, of the bow in the sky. And God then fills that promise with content. What does God give Noah? Anybody remember? We get to it. We may read ahead far enough. We may not. God gives Noah a set of laws. The Noahide laws, right? Have people heard of the phrase the Noahide laws? They're the rules that God gives. Well, it's a little bit later in the text. It's two chapters later. God gives Noah a set of rules that are going to be given from this time forward. And the rabbis call these the Noahide laws because they're laws that happen before the rules that happen at Sinai, but after Noah. And so the rabbis consider them the universal principles. The principles that all human beings, Muslim, Christian, non-religious communities, right? All communities have to live by. And then each community has its own set of principles that defines what it means to be a separate community. Right? Does that make sense? So Helen's a great point, right? Part of the setup here is they don't know what rules to live by. On the other hand, with Adam and Eve, we get a different problem. Or what was the problem with following the rules with Adam and Eve? Did they not know?
They just didn't follow them.
Yeah, well, at least Adam didn't follow them. And then maybe Eve didn't know. And then maybe Eve, you know, who knows? There's some debate about that, right? But for whatever it is, and what's the bridge, by the way, between Adam and Eve to Noah? How many generations happen? Do you know this? It's at the very end of last week's parsha, so we didn't read that. So you get 8 generations, right? You get Seth, who's the descendant of Adam and Eve. And then you get 7 more, or I guess 5 more births, and then Noah's born. So we're only 8 generations later, but somehow we've moved from a people that is this very small people, right? It's Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel, and then the mysterious women who they marry. We don't know where they came from. But it's a small group, to the vision of a world that is swarming with evil and destruction. One of the phrases that we get here, the earth was filled with lawlessness. What do you see when you imagine that picture, an earth filled with lawlessness?
If there weren't rules, how could there be lawlessness? Because there wasn't any opposite. I mean, that was the rule of law, the absence of rules. So it's kind of a revisionism in terms of no disrespect, but it doesn't make sense.
Well, who's going to say your name? Forgive me.
Bruce.
Bruce, right. You told me last night. So somebody help Bruce. How are you going to deal with this? If there's lawlessness and chaos because there's no law, so it doesn't make sense.
I'm Steve.
Hi, Steve.
I like your metaphor about parenting before. That's what this, you know, reminds me of. You know, we start and we make assumptions when we're first parents and we don't have any experience as parents. But we learn very quickly, you know, that you need to start, you learn while you're raising your children. God's learning as he's, you know, raising this people, right? And yeah, okay, we expect, God expects rules, but he didn't lay them down. Okay, now I know I got to lay them down, right?
So okay, so
I when you wrote this verse, I thought that's our Jenei Mitzvah moment, right? We've reached a point where it's a culmination. Okay, we have responsibility, but now we have the big job in front of us.
Now we got a lot to do. You're talking about this moment, right?
Yeah,
absolutely, right? And this morning, Madeline is going to get up there. She's lived a long time, 13
right.
years.
Right.
As I get older, I begin to understand the irony of that, right? 13 years, and she hasn't done anything yet.
And obviously communal.
Right. On the other hand, she's got a whole set of experiences putting her in a position to begin to be part of something where there are obligations on her, there are responsibilities on her, and she can have expectations and accountability with the people around her. So this is our Bnei Mitzvah moment. We're at this moment right here, and we don't even exist as a people, right? So let's go back to this thing about lawlessness. So we're, yeah, go ahead.
What's the Hebrew word for lawlessness?
Excellent. That's Hamas, I think, right?
Hamas,
right? No relation to the terrorist group.
Yeah,
pretty low.
I remember I went to Rabbi Melman.
Yeah.
I was so proud of myself. I said, Hamas! Hamas! I said, totally different word. Oh, well. Yeah.
Harry, to me, lawlessness is by definition the absence of laws. The word that jumps out at me is corruption. Corruption to me is a violation of objectively moral and ethical standards that people are supposed to conduct themselves.
So what's your conclusion, Aaron? So there's lawlessness, which means there's an absence of law. Presumably then there's chaos. But if there's also corruption, what does that imply?
To me, it implies there should be some universal ethical and moral standards that people should understand without being told by God.
Okay, so that this is brilliant, right? So then there's two baskets of things. The things that you got to know that you wouldn't realize if someone didn't tell you. You stop at the red.
Who says an ethical gene?
What's that?
An ethical gene?
But we're made in God's image. Yeah. We have that.
Yeah. Or that it's innate. I don't know whether it's genetic or what. But let's tease it out for a second, and then we can sort of untease it, okay? So the things that you ought to know, because when you see a red, I'm sorry, that you wouldn't know, somebody teaches you. You stop at the red. But there are some things that you know by nature. Well, now let's test that against Cain and Abel, okay? Cain pleads for himself in the Midrash, claiming what? How would you defend yourself if you're Cain? Remember, you're the first people.
Maybe. The devil made me do it.
I didn't know I was going to kill him. I jumped on him because I was mad, and he stopped breathing. And God, you know, God, like a parent saying, "Get off your brother! You're going to kill him." How would I know that? Right. So maybe you're right. There, maybe the whole conception of murder, because we've inherited thousands of years of human history, we feel like it's innate. But the moral objectivity about murder is something that had to evolve over time. I don't know. But either way, what you're lifting up is the question of whether or not what was happening at the time was the absence of law and the absence even of sort of a baseline morality. Whatever it is, think about God's reaction to that. Whether or not there were things that innately people ought to have known, or it was all just a system of law that they never learned. God creates these people. It's like having a huge family, but never telling them what to do and what not to do. And this family is killing each other and going crazy. And so logically, you do at that point what?
Wipe them out.
Wipe the slate.
Just start over again. Oh, this is not working. This is not good. Let me destroy them all. Okay?
Concluded from the first experiment that those were not the right conditions, and just is going to cleaning up the labs and starting again.
Well, except what's your name?
Karen.
Okay, Karen. So right, so the scientist says the petri dish is contaminated. I'm going to clean it out, dump it, and start over again. Except there's one problem with that. Right, there's one problem with that in this narrative. He's taken Noah. So Noah presumably is still infected. Right, Noah is in the petri dish too. Except that Noah is
a righteous
man.
In his time.
So that's
which means he is. Which means he is.
All right, hold it. So this is exactly where we want to go. So I want you to take a couple minutes with a partner, and I want you to talk about the question of Noah's righteousness. First, before you look at the study sheet, just ask yourself the question, what makes Noah righteous? Right? Why is he different? Is he the same rotten, part of the future tradition, or is there something new? And after you talk a little bit about it, you can reread the first paragraph. After you do that, then read the study sheet and react to the text one at a time. Folks, just let me give you one last instruction. Don't read through all three texts on the study sheet. Read them one at a time and talk about them as you come to them. Okay? Everybody good?
Enjoy.
We'll take, 10 minutes. Can we go to 10? So when Rabbi Middleman walks out in a huff, disgusted by what we determined, we'll realize it just doesn't matter. So you're excused in advance. All right. Madeline would be very sad if no rabbi showed up.
The one with the campus.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay. So you're ready to go.
Ready to go.
Go for it.
You can drill down. You can drill down two or three or four levels here. I started in my head at the top. Verse 9, righteousness sort of is being defined here as a relationship with God and a relationship with our peers. Walk with God, I don't know what that means, we'll come back to that. Blameless in his age, I take to mean he does okay with his fellows. So the definition here, if you take it, has two parts. A relationship, how you're dealing with God, and how you're dealing with your peers. Now I have a trouble. Drill down.
Okay, pause. Let's just pause, because I don't want you to go too fast and leave people behind, all right? So let's just lift up what Sam just articulated. Very important. It's already thinking about righteousness, both in the context of the way you relate to God, where everything all started, but this sort of infinitude, this abstraction, but also where you relate to other human beings. And the rabbis are going to puzzle through righteousness in both contexts. Okay, go ahead.
All right, so drill down to the second level. What does walk with God mean? If it means you have a perfect relationship with God, then there's no need to talk about your relationship with your peers, because automatically you're a saint, so to speak, and you're going to deal well with your peers, your brothers and sisters.
How do you know that?
Well, if you live that kind of a life, okay, now I'm going to put aside sin and missing the mark. And I'm going to say if you have that kind of relationship with God, you hit the mark. You hit the bullseye. Okay, every time. So if you
let me just lift up. You're making an assertion about what it means to walk with God that's full of content. You've determined for yourself. I'm not saying you're wrong. But,
exactly.
Yeah,
and I said that
just
at the top.
Clear, right?
I said at the top. There's a real question here. What walk with God means.
And you're saying what it means is to be behave morally and ethically with other human beings. You're saying in a matter of flow, one flows from the other.
Yes.
Because you said you're a saint, and if you're a saint, therefore you... So you're then refusing the two things, right? If you walk with God, you're righteous, therefore you're righteous with other human beings.
Automatically you're righteous.
Okay.
Therefore, since they put both in here, I have to understand that walk with God means something less than being saintly.
Uh-huh.
Walking means arm in arm or a partnership where... you're not fully controlled, and you can miss the mark. You can still sort of walk with God and miss the mark, and we say that just recently in the last month or so. Okay, and we can miss the mark in many ways, miss the mark in our relationship with God, and more often missing the mark with our relationship with our parents, our sisters and brothers and children and our fellows. So this allows, at least as I read it, for a relationship with the other that encompasses some kind of free will within us to do well with our peers and maybe not so well.
Okay, all right. So this is sort of where we get the notion of free will, and the relationship to God doesn't determine the relationship with human beings, right, Harry?
To me, the walking with God and righteousness aren't necessarily synonymous.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because these passages that we just read suggest that Noah walked with God. That to me was defined in the Torah portion as blindly adhering to
Beautiful.
What God told him to do.
Okay.
And the rabbi said, wait a second, that's not righteous. Unlike Abraham, you didn't try to save these wicked people. And that was a shortcoming. That made you less righteous. Maybe God chose Noah because he was the best available, and that's the reference to he was blameless in his age. He was all that God had to work with. But the fact that he just built the ark, got in with his family, and took off and didn't try to save people was considered less righteous than he might otherwise
got
have been.
It. Okay, so everybody clear? Harry sees very distinctly what it means to walk with God and be righteous in relation to human beings, and as evidenced by the fact that he does whatever God tells him to do, which is build an ark. Okay, I'll build the ark. That's the one act, the one way in which Noah has agency in his partnership with God, walking with God, is just doing whatever God says. And then doesn't behave with righteousness, or one could question the extent to which he behaves with righteousness with his fellow human beings. And the Hasidic commentator in the bottom is making the point quite clearly, his non-act with other human beings, i.e. not warning them, not doing something with them, not engaging them in the project of building this ark, is an act of unrighteousness in relation to human beings, which shows you that he walks with God, but isn't really that righteous with human beings.
But the idea of an idea didn't exist in that time.
What idea?
Right,
what I do.
No, I'm saying is that the idea didn't exist. It was a reflex. Basically, I see Noah as a unicellular organism, and I see Abraham as a multifaceted. You know, he wasn't capable.
What does that mean?
When I hit my knee moves. It doesn't need me to get involved with this. But when I decide whether or not to move my knee, I don't want to bother my friend, I don't want to disrupt the table, I want to make coffee, it's conceptualizing. I'm taking it to a different plane. And I see Noah as a reflex.
Right, so but it's not that the idea didn't exist, it's that Abraham related to this monotheistic God differently than Noah related to the same monotheistic. I mean, it is take it as a story as opposed to an abstraction. Yes.
Maxine.
But that's what
God wanted in Genesis. Mm-hmm. He wanted them to do what he said.
Yeah,
and not to do
what
he did not want to say. So we have here an evolution of what we think.
Yeah.
That God wants. So it's not a...
So think, let's play that out for a second, God's growth, right? God thinks, boom, I can just do this and people will follow. The
right.
first act, Adam and Eve, God learns, wow, it's not going to be that way. Then there's murder. Then there's Hamas throughout the land, and God wipes out the whole science experiment with a little bit and tries to start over again. All this is building towards the Sinaitic moment, the moment at Sinai. Where does this moment actually happen? The moment at Sinai, what makes it real? What makes the covenant actually happen? Is it God saying, do this? When is the covenant actualized?
No, not only did they take an action, they took an action as a community. It was the first time they did it. This wasn't one family. This was a people.
Okay, so first of all, God is not just relating to Abraham and saying, Abraham, do this, or Eve, do this, or Noah, do this. There's a collective, and God presents that covenant to the collective, but there's no covenant yet. What is required for there actually to be a covenant, Stan?
You have to accept it.
Right, the moment that the covenant is actualized is not save any Shema. That's the phrase the Israelites use to say, yes, all this we will do, and we will hear. We will act on what we are doing, and we will continue to hear your revelation. In other words, hang on one second, there's consent. The journey, I think, that Maxine just implied happens for God is the journey towards understanding human beings who have the free will that Stan lifted up before, and so that in order to be in covenant with them, in order to expect things of them, in order to have obligations from them to you, one has to get their consent. And they can't enter into the covenant without their consent. The culminating moment of God's relationship with human beings is related to people as a community that have given their consent. Does that make sense? Yeah. Say your name.
Susan.
That's democracy. Exactly right. That's a little foreshadow. I mean, this is all going to a political reality. I have a community organized. Right? So of course I see the lens. This is where I'm going.
So, and I apologize that I was late. So I don't know if I missed this moment. But what is coming into my mind as we're looking at it this time is currently I'm teaching a class on Midot and the Musar movement. And one of the things that keeps coming up is the concept that, and I know that you somehow, we was tying in with the Sinai and becoming B'nai Mitzvah, if I understand correctly of what I missed, that when one of the reasons they say that Bar Mitzvah was at 13, was the concept that we only actually have a Yetzer Hara when we're born, and the Yetzer HaTov, this is one statement that I was reading lately, and that the Yetzer HaTov comes at 13. And if we play with that concept, it plays with this very nicely, that we had the Yetzer Hara, which gives us our inclinations to do many different things, which can be positive, even though it's called Hara, because it lets us reproduce and various other things that are good for the world, and the first mitzvah that's even given to us. But that it takes a while before we get that idea of what really is the good, and that perhaps that's where we're going with, when all the laws come into being at Mount Sinai, and for that we can't take on, and it deals with the commitment thing, that children can't take on the mitzvot until they really get that other part of themselves, that the cognitive development to get to that stage. And so we also had to, God and us, had to get to that stage before we could...
Beautiful. Okay? So if we take that out as a metaphor, the individual development, the moral development of a person, of a human being, you have an arc of moral development where you begin to recognize the implications of your yetzers. Right? And the Yetzer HaTov needs to become an overlay of understanding that our acts have consequences. So too with both humanity and God. It's all a learning curve to get us to Sinai to understand that to be a community means we actually have to understand the implications and the ramifications of all of our actions. And if we're going to operate as a community, then we need to go through some sort of process. And the whole slavery and Exodus story is part of that process of community formation. And then it's all tested in the wilderness, the 40 years of wandering, with lots and lots of episodes where it starts at Sinai, but it actually gets tested a lot in the wilderness after Sinai. That's what it means to be a community in formation. So the reason why we do community organizing is communities are organized, right? I mean, as a friend of mine, my mentor is a guy named Arnie Graff. And Arnie Graff was a community organizer who started working as an undergraduate during the Civil Rights Movement. And he became a member of the national staff of the organization that trained Barack Obama when he was a community organizer in South Side Chicago. So that's sort of the orientation. But he likes to say to me, Jonah, you have to be very sensitive. Because a community organizer by nature, when he or she shows up to a community, his or her presence is an implicit insult. Right? We're going to organize this community. We're going to make some change. Oh, you mean it's not okay right now? Right? The nature of community organizing is to say, communities that are already organized, there's stuff happening. The Hamas doesn't just mean there isn't a social order. There is. It's just completely lawless. Right? And so there's a lot of pain and suffering happening. It needs to be disorganized and reorganized. And the journey here is to disorganize and reorganize the way God relates to humanity and the way humanity relates to itself. That's what this is about. So a community organizer shows up and sees Bethel Temple of Northern Westchester, and what's the name of the mosque across town? The Upper Westchester Muslim Society, and then the church next door? Where is it?
First Congregational Church.
Okay, all right, and lots of other institutions, lots of people, lots of businesses. That's all organized. I mean, when I drove here, the light went red, and I stopped, and then the light went green. So part of this is saying, well, how do we at this moment in time need to disorganize and reorganize this community and have a sana in it going for us? What's our collective consent to the obligations we want to have with one another? Because the truth is, it can't always be the Super Bowl. Sinai happened, and in a flash, it's over. We're moving on. We're in the wilderness, and things are going wrong, right? What's the first thing that happens after Sinai?
Golden.
Yeah, the golden calf, and the rumblings at the well, right? There's all kinds of breakdown. You think, oh, they have their bar mitzvah, they're done. Right, Madeline, I guarantee you we'll be grounded next week for something. I mean, I know it's a couple parents I said. But you became bar mitzvah! You said yes to the covenant! What's the matter, right? As soon as we make commitments to one another, we wouldn't need to make commitments if we were perfect. We make commitments because we're imperfect, right? Because we miss the mark. That's why we do this, and we constantly check back in with each other. The challenge to a society is, once it thinks it's all worked out, we sort of go to sleep. Part of what community organizing asks is to constantly reflect and evaluate and agitate ourselves. Are we the community that we want to be? Let's not just show up and say, oh, Shabbat Shalom, how are you? Fine. Right? Remember the nursing care worker story from last night? People were not fine. I mean, on the surface, we were fine. You know, I mean, look, most of the people in my congregation, most of them have good jobs, live in good homes, right? Things are fine. I mean, we don't live in urban blight in my community. But there are, not far underneath the surface, real stories and concerns. And the practice of organizing is to constantly check back in with ourselves, our lives, and our communal narrative to ask, how can we stand again at Sinai this year and ratify a new set of commitments going forward? Okay? Okay, so let's go back to the text. Any questions, comments, reflections? Before we go back to the text. Okay. We're doing well so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's see how this plays out. Oh, no, well, let's go back to our commentaries, okay? So what's, in essence, Rashi lifting up for us? Right, Rashi, classical. Pretty much whenever you're looking at commentary, you want to look at Rashi first.
It's relativity. You know, that he's good for his time. In this snapshot.
Is Rashi saying that? He's good only relative to his age. What's Rashi trying to do here?
He's saying that there's two sides.
He's saying there's two ways to understand Noah. One is, he is only righteous in the context of the people who are around him. Or, the other way to understand Noah is, what's the other way of thinking about Noah? If it's not just relative to his own era.
Yeah, righteousness is not absolute standard. It's not like a merit badge. You choose a certain level, you're righteous, and that's it.
Well, that's sort of implied in this first understanding, right? That he's only relatively, you know, like, well, there's a lot of crazy things going on.
I'm Nancy, right? That he was righteous. That he was sort of the best of the best.
And how do you know that, right? How does Rashi lift up that piece? He's righteous because if you put him...
Yeah, if you put him in a different context, he would have been an Abraham.
Okay, so Rashi is teasing out the tension between whether or not righteousness is determined by whoever else is living around you, or you are absolute, and so regardless of who's around you, you would emerge as righteous. And Noah's only problem was that the model was so bad, he doesn't look so great because everything around him is bad. But had he been in a group with real righteous people, he would have been even more righteous.
But doesn't it make him more righteous if he can maintain his righteousness among wicked people? As opposed to just going with the flow of
I don't know. What do you think?
Right. Absolutely.
Why?
But
Ahead,
here you have the entire world corrupt, lawless, murdering, whatever they're doing, and you have one guy who rose up above that and did not participate. Now, I didn't owe a lot of credit. That is a very difficult thing to do. So I think he's being sold short here. And God has this one guy. It's a miracle. I got a guy I can rely on.
So for you, it's the Petri dish example isn't really fair. Noah is not only not infected, it's almost like God surgically removes the one piece of this experiment that is pure and gets rid of the rest. Right? To play out the analogy that you raised earlier. Yeah?
Lisa.
Karen? No, Lisa. Oh, who's Karen? Oh, you're Karen. Sorry, Lisa.
But did he rise up, or he just chose not to participate? That's my question. He didn't really rise up. If he didn't let the people know what was going on and didn't set an example...
All right, Lisa, for you, if he did rise up, what would that have... What would be the content of that choice to rise up? What would he have done?
That he would have gone to the people and told them what was going on, as opposed to just blindly building the ark and letting God destroy the universe.
Okay, so ADL has this great program called Choosing to Participate, and they really tease out the moral content of the question, what does it mean to be a bystander versus what does it mean to be a leader, right? And there's a tension. There's not a right answer to this, but it's a question. When you're in Nazi Germany, which is for us the ultimate paradigm of this, is it morally conscionable just to do nothing and say, I will not participate? Or does one, right, which is in essence what you're sort of lifting up, is that Noah... In a world where there was no other choice but either to be evil or do nothing, he did nothing. But Lisa's saying, no, he should have done something proactive. Now, what might have happened to Noah, by the way, if he had gone running around saying, 60 more days, 60 more days, the end of the world is coming.
God might have chosen something.
Right? Okay. Steve.
Well, that's interesting because in the next commentary, it says, this is a sin. As a result, from that time on, he was no longer perfect. So Bill and I, we're kind of teasing this parallel universe thing. What if he did challenge God? What if he did this? You know, where did we go from there?
And what would happen? What do you think?
I don't know. You know, we didn't get that far.
And we do have the model because we have Abraham arguing back with God.
Right.
Not so when he was going to murder his only son, by the way, when he was going to kill a whole bunch of people.
For a revisionist, you know, he's, of course, he didn't. This is part of the story. And it's, you know, as Maxine talked about, it's building blocks. Mm-hmm. You know, we get there.
Let's get a new voice.
Phyllis, hi. I'm going to take a few sentences from this article in today's Jewish Week. Okay. Each of us makes the choice to move forward comfortably, like Noah, or as Abraham, to challenge ourselves and those around us to make a difference. So the message of Parshat Noah this year is to challenge our comfort so that we take personal responsibility in our homes, in our synagogues, and in our communities to take small steps that together lead to a better world for all.
Very nice. Okay. So this is an argument by the way you're saying.
I gave you.
Noah's
Jessica Haller and Miguel Savage.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Steve. No. Harris, sorry.
The one piece that we're not talking about is the fact that Noah acted in accordance with a specific instruction from God. Uh-huh. It's one thing to say, is it right, is it wrong, what should I do, how do I be righteous? There's a push and pull here. There's a very fundamental and troubling question, which is, even when you disagree with God's law or God's instruction, is it okay for you as a human being to say, I'm gonna ignore God? And if you go to the Abraham analogy, when God specifically instructed him to kill Isaac, he was ready to do it. Mm-hmm. There was no instruction when he was pleading for the wicked. He just chose to do that because he thought it was appropriate.
Very good. All right. Very good. So let's compare. All right. So let's juxtapose three characters. Okay. Maybe we'll even get to the fourth. So you've got Noah, who is often analogized as in our text with Abraham, but it's also analogized with Jonah. Okay, the ancient Jonah. Right? Okay, tell me what you were thinking.
Well, I don't know. So when we were talking, I started thinking about Jonah because Jonah was, in a way, that kind of a passive actor as Noah was, you know, and he didn't really want the responsibility of doing what God wanted him to do. So he tried to sort of hide from it.
Yeah, that making him not a passive actor. Jonah
operates. Well, he's making a choice. That's true.
Oh, he acts with total agency. He runs really hard. He gets on a ship.
Yeah,
he acts a lot, but he acts in opposition to that very specific command. Right? God gives him a very specific command. Go to Nineveh and warn them. Which shows God's evolution. Right now, God is saying, having been through Sodom and Gomorrah, having been through the wiping out of all of creation, warn them. I want to warn them because I believe they actually have the opportunity to recommit themselves.
Right.
They could ratify a new covenant, right?
Be sure.
Okay, and Jonah, not only shirks from it, Jonah acts, but acts in opposition to, right? He runs away and doesn't want to warn the people. So it's the ironic turning of the Abraham character. The Abraham character who's not given a specific instruction, but he's given inside information. Now, what's that about? Right, both Jonah and Noah get related to by God as saying, okay, I'm going to go do this, and so I need you to do X. One does it exactly, the other doesn't do it exactly. Abraham is told, by the way, you know those people of Sodom and Gomorrah? I'm going to wipe them out. What's going on there?
I think it's God testing him to see, well, now I'm putting you in a position where you have to exercise your own views of what would be morally correct. Let's see what you do.
So
you
in essence,
over to your own.
So what does God do? So God is testing Abraham to see what he'll do. Why would he do that? Or why would God do that? I shouldn't use the
need a character reference. If he was going to be the guy, he wanted to see what he's worth.
So there's one, right, the whole traditional interpretation where there's 10 trials of Abraham. This is one. The binding of Isaac is another. Okay, yeah.
The big difference is there's a communication. Right? There's no communication with Noah. He just listens. There's no communication with Jonah. But with Abraham, there's a communication. But God.
Well, let me push the word a little bit deeper, because I think you're absolutely right, Steve. But it's not that there's no communication, because God talks to Noah. God talks to Jonah. God talks to Abraham. They're talking.
It's a two-way communication.
There's actual relationship.
Right.
There's actual relationship. Right? A community standing in covenant assumes that there has been. You can't get into consent if you don't actually have a relationship. It's a back and a forth. Right? There is not a save in Ishmael. We're going to do this, and we're going to hear this. We're going to be in a constant dialogue with you. It's what Martin Buber calls the ultimate I thou moment.
Reciprocal.
There's a constant process of reciprocation. Whereas Noah and Jonah both model a top-down style of leadership. Do this because I said so. No, I'm not going to. Yes, I am going to. That's not a relationship. Right? And this non-relationship is what gets us into trouble from the very beginning. It's all God's learning curve that to be in relationship with humanity, to ask obligations of them, to ask commitments of them, is to listen, to make space. So now let's go to Abraham and distinguish Abraham, right? So there is some sort of relationship. There is effective communication. But let's think about this testing thing. If you test someone, whether it's a kid in a classroom taking an exam or it's somebody in your life who you're testing, what does it presume about them that you are willing to give them a test?
There's hope.
For what?
That
they will do something. In other words, it assumes agency. It assumes power of that person to do in the world. From the beginning of time, God does not assume any agency. It's like the Garden of Eden is these playthings. It's like a diorama. My favorite is when kids in Sunday school make dioramas of the garden, because that's what it is. It's not real. It's a sort of mural. Actual life, living, is mistakes, is missing the mark and making the mark. But the opportunity that we have as human beings to actually be able to do something, the moment at Sinai assumes that Israel can respond. Right? Community organizing assumes the answers don't all come from the top. This is what you ought to do. We ought to build more of this. We ought to do more of that. Community organizing says, let's assume about, well, let's test ourselves. Let's put each other through a trial. If we spend some time talking to one another, we might actually discern what it is that we could do together to make the world better. And we might actually then be bought into the process of making the world better. So God, let me just finish the thought one more second, I'm sorry. God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy this city. That makes space for Abraham to say, why would you do that? And then they get into a dialogue about what does it mean to be innocent and guilty and to have a community. Yes?
The community has to recognize that their thoughts are going to be heard, that they're going to be able to communicate. Not necessarily they're going to agree, but someone's going to hear what they're saying.
That's exactly right. Consent assumes that there is a hearing as well as a talking. It assumes that there is a hearing as well as a talking. Let me just, as a parenthetical side note, one of the things that Rabbi Davidson and Bill and I and Maria last night and Jeff and Dana were talking about is this whole question, and when I really appreciated when Rabbi Davidson introduced me, he framed my work in terms not only of sort of rethinking the way we do social and economic justice in this country, but the way synagogues interact with one another inside, the way we build relationships within a congregation. And you got a picture of that last night with all the house meetings with people telling stories. But I want to lift up a very specific kind of example of the way that we operate in this mode of community organizing. How many of you have been to a meeting at a synagogue, maybe this one, where the meeting went way over the time that it had been scheduled for. How many of you have been to a meeting where there was not a clear agenda? No? Every meeting you've been to had a very clear agenda? Okay, well, I'm not dissing on the meetings at this congregation. Not this temple, my temple, where I go, okay, because I go to this all the time. Or where the agenda wasn't actually what got discussed. Or the most agitational question, where nothing actually really happened. Okay, this happens. This is a norm of church life, synagogue life, in business, and in schools, right? It happens everywhere, okay? So one of the practices of community organizing is that when you walk into the room, the meeting starts when the meeting was scheduled to start. And as people are trickling in, say, what, you actually started? But we always start 15 or 20 minutes late. So I came 15 or 20 minutes late. There's no, like, oh, let's wait for so-and-so to show up. We start when we say we're going to start. And there's a time on the board that's when we're going to end. And that's when the meeting ends. And there's a timekeeper watching the time. And I'm very cognizant. We have 5 more minutes. Because we said we're going to end this Torah study at 10:30. We're going to end the Torah study at 10:30. And there's a clear agenda, which is timed out in front of the room at a community organizing meeting, so that each topic is laid out with an amount of time. And there's a timekeeper who says, we've now talked about this for 15 minutes. We're going to hold ourselves accountable, and we're going to move on. But here's, I think, the most powerful part of this kind of practice, of the way that we have meetings. At the top of the agenda, before the sort of different things we're going to talk about in the amount of time, is a goal for the meeting. And the leader of the meeting will get up and will say, folks, we believe we've come together tonight to discuss X. The agenda we constructed in order to do X is to talk about A, then B, then C. Is that all right with you? And presumably, coming into the meeting, everybody in advance had input into what the goal of the meeting was going to be and what was going to be discussed. Because that way, there is consent. To stand, even in that small moment, a business meeting at the synagogue, there is a Sinaitic moment where we're going to hold ourselves accountable to the relationships we have with one another. If we say that we're going to start at a certain time, we start at that time. If we say we're going to talk about X, we're going to talk about X. If we say we're going to end by a certain time, we end by a certain time. And then, nobody wants to busy themselves. Right? We're all, how many of you are busy? People say, how are you? I'm busy. Right? There's a million other places we can be. We want to leave that night, if it was a 7 o'clock meeting that was scheduled to 8:30, we want to know that at 8:30 something moved. That we didn't just fill ourselves up with activity, but there was action. Right? Activity is where you just keep busy. Right? Congregations are full of activities. Right? Rabbi Cushman likes to write how synagogues are a beehive of activity. But often nothing actually happens. When things happen, when things move. And not only in the political and social justice realm. The attorney general said yes, and the conditions changed in nursing homes. That's an action. Right? Something has moved. But within, a group of people engaged in Torah enriched themselves and made a commitment to keep doing their Jewish learning. Think about the action of Sinai. A community is going to move together in the wilderness and get to this land. We could wander around forever. What's the point? Right? Wandering in the wilderness is activity. Getting into the promised land, now that's action. And the final practice of this kind of way of working is that at the end of every meeting, there is a time devoted to evaluation. And in the evaluation, the question is asked, did we do tonight what we said we were going to do? Let's hold ourselves accountable. Did a change happen based on our meeting tonight that we said it was going to? And if not, why? What can we grow and how can we learn? So the next time we assemble, we're more effective and we're better at it. That's saying, did we stand at the mountain and actually not only do the nasei part, the nishma part, the hearing of each other's concerns and the ratifying of commitment together, but did we actually do it?
Sometimes those meetings, I think, is about next steps. I know that I've worked on a lot of those kind of meetings, and the last thing you do is, okay, what are the next steps?
And what are the commitments that we're going to make? So one of the things I talked to the rabbis about in preparation for, and the people on the Tikkun Olam Council, for this weekend is to do some sort of a commitment card at the end. So it isn't just, oh, we have scholar residents, we were all
right,
entertained
right,
for...
Home.
Yeah, and we go home and that was nice. It was nice, right? Actually, people get a piece of paper, and I talk to the rabbis about treating my visit not only as scholarship, but as action. What's the reaction? And we ask the question, well, how will we know we got a reaction? If people hand in a commitment card at the end of the weekend and say, I'd like to know more. I'd like to attend a training. I'd like to consider being on the leadership team. If they check off yes, then you say, yeah, we got a reaction. And people know how to locate themselves and actually act on what they experienced.
So are you saying that Moses...
We have 1 minute, so I'm going to bring it to close. You have the last comment, I'm going to close it up.
Moses spent too much time with God, his meeting ran over, the people lost faith, and so Moses' problem.
Absolutely.
That was the golden calf.
Absolutely. Okay. Right? There had been an agreement. I'm going to go... He lost his base. Community organizing, how do you keep the base of people together so that you have their consent so you can do stuff? It's very nice for Moses and God, they're hanging out at the top of the mountain. That's not a religion. A religion is when people show up. You all showed up this morning. You all showed up. That means that the people that organized this weekend understood something about what you were interested in. How many of you have shown up for something and no one else came? Right? So let's just lift up then the last... Somebody read this. I just think that this is such a beautiful paragraph. Somebody read the Al-Sheikh. Why are Jews?
Abraham was different. Abraham taught the world proper behavior. And
oh, go do the whole thing. Why are Jews not considered? That's okay.
These are the generations of Noah who walked with God. Why are Jews not considered to be the descendants of Noah, but rather of Abraham? The explanation is that even though Noah was righteous and perfect in his actions, he was not the ideal of the righteous Jew. Noah walked with God, not with people, not with others. He was not interested in humanity and the environment. His righteousness was directed inward, to himself and his family. He was commanded by God to build an ark, but built it board by board and nail by nail for 120 consecutive years. And it never crossed his mind that there might be a way to avert God's decree and to save the world from destruction. Abraham was different. Abraham taught the world proper behavior and knowledge of God. When God wished to overturn Sodom, Abraham did all in his power to save those wicked people.
This is a 16th century commentator living in Turkey and Greece and Israel? We're not talking about a modern American or scholar who has the benefit of living in the most democratic, pluralistic, and happy place for Jews in human history outside the land of Israel. That's incredibly radical. It's radical if you think about it. And in essence, he's teasing out part of the journey God makes to understand, I can't just relate to all of humanity and say, everybody do this or else. But rather, I've got to get particular. I've got to relate to Israel in a certain way. I've got to relate to Islam in a certain way. I've got to relate to Christianity in a certain way that is going to work for this collective group of people to ratify a particular way of being in relationship with me. Because as we know, if I told you, well, this is how it works at Temple Israel in Boston, just go do it, you would say, yeah, but this is Chappaqua, Rabbi. Right? This isn't New England. This is New York. This is a particular community in a particular moment in time that needs to organize itself in a particular way. That's the learning, and that's why we are the people of Israel. Because we have a particular history, a particular story, and a particular way of understanding our relationship with God. And inside of that, we have a covenant that we make, not only with God that dates back to here, but with one another. And what makes this work so fun is, in every generation, in fact, I would argue every year, we gather again at the High Holy Days and ask ourselves, in what ways did we miss the mark? And in what ways this year are we going to reorganize ourselves to stand together as a community and once again ratify the commitment and the covenant they're making with one another and with God? Shabbat Shalom.